This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for uplifting choral works, a museum exhibit of landscape masterworks, or a multi-sensory feast, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. I'm your host, Diane Mack. An act of cyber harassment and humiliation that captured international attention is now the subject of Tyler Suite, a 9-piece choral movement dedicated to the memory of Tyler Clementi, who took his life after being bullied by his roommate during his first weeks of college. The Symphony Chorus of New Orleans presents the inaugural regional performance of Tyler Suite, working to spread the word about bullying. Symphony Chorus Music Director Stephen Edwards is here. Welcome.
Thank you, Diane.
This is a new work that has been traveling the country. Tell us, how did it come to be?
This is a work that was commissioned by the Tyler Clementi Foundation. This is a foundation that was established by the family of Tyler Clementi after his death. And in addition to the foundation's work combating bullying through education and media, they wanted to specifically remember their son's connections with music and commission a piece of music. And so they put together this piece, which features a solo violin, a mixed chorus, a number of solos, and piano.
This caught the attention of composer Stephen Schwartz of Pippin and Wicked fame and other top composers. How did they become involved in the project?
I think it was something where the various connections that Stephen Schwartz had, where he approached various colleagues. It really is a wonderful list of composers with connections to the musical theater and classical music world. John Buchino, Anne Hampton Calloway, Craig Carnelia, John Corigliano, Stephen Flaherty, Nolan Gasser, Jack Heggie, Lance Horn, and as we've already mentioned, Stephen Schwartz.
Now, who was Tyler Clementi?
Tyler Clementi was a young violinist. He was a music major at Rutgers. He had been concertmaster of his youth orchestra. He was in his first weeks of college when he took his own life. And that tragedy has resulted in his family making good out of evil. This piece is not a requiem. It's not even really a memorial. It's a concert dedicated to promoting kindness and encouraging action so that listeners will feel emboldened and engaged to take on bullying when they see it, to speak up.
So how is his story told in Tyler's Suite?
The suite begins with a meditation for solo violin and wordless chorus. The violinist doesn't represent Tyler, but the violin part does. And the various movements of the suite are told from the point of view of his family. So the first number that is sung, there is a sort of baritenor solo that is clearly Tyler. In the last number, there is a solo that is Tyler singing. But the other movements are told from the point of view of his brother, from his father. And there are two numbers that represent the point of view of his mother, one of which is a piece called The Tyler Show, which explores her experience of taking her story to the media, of talking about this on CNN and NBC, and the experience of the commodification of her story. The motivation for this was a positive thing, but still turning her experience into a public act and what that felt like. And the other is a heart-wrenchingly beautiful love ballad by Anne Hampton Calloway.
A mist of silver from the moon, through the window of my room, the shadow reaching out across the floor, and in the half light of my mind, I reach out and try to find the memory of your voice again, talk with you as I
the concert is not just Tyler's suite. We're beginning with a 10-minute piece called Five Hebrew Love Songs by Eric Whitaker. It also happens to be for violin, chorus, and piano. And these are songs that Eric Whitaker wrote to texts of his then fiancée, now bride. And after Tyler's suite, we're going to perform a selection by New Orleans composer Moses Hogan called I Am His Child, which is a different take on the same subject of love and being bullied or being talked about. It's really an uplifting story.
And there are other choruses joining you?
Yes. The New Orleans Gay Men's Chorus is joining us, and the Delgado Community College Chamber Choir, which I also direct.
And I understand that Tyler's mom will be in attendance.
Yes. Mrs. Clementi is flying here from New Jersey, and she will be at the concert and will speak to the audience a little bit about her son and about the Tyler Clementi Foundation. And if people would like to know more, they'll have a chance to talk to her.
You're talking about hope and being uplifted. The name Tyler's Suite has a double meaning.
I think so. The word suite means it follows. You know, a suite is something where there's another piece afterwards, or a suite of rooms is there's another room. And in this case, Tyler's Suite is about what follows after Tyler. And in this case, what follows is people who have chosen to make something positive out of something evil. It's a truly inspiring story, and I'm excited to share it with our singers and with our audience, and really happy that we're able to bring Mrs. Clementi here to tell her story to the public as well.
Symphony Chorus Music Director Stephen Edwards, thanks.
You're welcome.
He was just a boy. He was my son. The last of three. My youngest one. He could make me laugh and sometimes cry. Now he's left me here to wonder why.
How will I live still in his teens? We'll never reach his hopes and dreams.
The Symphony Chorus of New Orleans presents the regional premiere of Tyler's Suite, Sunday, 2:30 p.m. at Temple Sinai, 6227 St. Charles Avenue. More info on the Tyler Clementi Foundation is online at tylerclementi.org. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. A new exhibit at the New Orleans Museum of Art comes from the personal collection of Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen. And he bought only the best. 39 paintings are on display from some of the most famous artists in the world, starting in the 1600s. Exhibit curator Vanessa Schmid pointed to some of the highlights with WWNO's Eileen Fleming.
My name is Vanessa Schmid, and I am the in-house curator for the show.
So we are here on the first floor of the museum, and there is a selection of paintings. Tell me about the grouping and why they were selected to be in the first room.
Generally, the exhibition is chronological. However, there are ways in which I step away from that and when it makes sense and have thematic area. For example, I have one area devoted to views of Venice.
Now, some of these artists are extraordinarily well known. Give us a list of the top 10 here, or the Hall of Fame in the world of art.
Well, of course, the most recognizable, perhaps, is Monet, Claude Monet. We have five paintings by Monet, and then also complemented by other Impressionists and Neo- and Post-Impressionists, Paul Cézanne, Paul Signac, Henri Cross, a lesser-known but fascinating Impressionist, and, of course, some of the other greatest hits are an outstanding landscape by Gustav Klimt. And then moving forward in time, there is a spectacular David Hockney, Some great American painters are represented, such as Thomas Moran, Edward Hopper. And I also, some of my personal favorites include Canaletto and Turner.
And what is it about landscapes did Paul Allen see as so important for his collection?
One of the things he said in an interview is how he talks about how travel really was important to him as a child and going to museums while traveling. And I think moving outward from that, something that really comes out in the show for me is, for all of us, how traveling to new places fixes memory in space and time. And I think that's a fascinating element of what landscape can do that's very vivid.
Okay, let's take a close look at a few. And here we move on to the well-known Canals of Venice.
Yes, so I have arranged in this section a series of six paintings that are views of Venice, and they range from the 1740s to the 1870s, so it's pretty much about a century of artists looking at Venice. And with Canaletto, we have his wonderful, detailed, nostalgic views. He was known for his meticulous detail of the palaces and their architecture. An artist who was looking at Canaletto and created his complete individual and astounding own vision of Venice is William Turner. Turner earned his fame as a watercolorist, which I think certainly informs his late style. His late style is really defined by kind of dreamy views, blurred vision. Yet, one will notice that his architecture is actually quite precise, and that I think is partly related to his great interest in Canaletto. Canaletto did inspire him, although they were a century apart, to visit Venice.
Okay. I doubt there's anyone that would mistake that one.
Yes, it is an example, as well, one exemplar of the Water Lily series by Claude Monet. It became really his signature subject, but also was his way to explore his interests in the changing of light over the course of a day.
And now, Vanessa, around the corner, I see what looks like a neon Grand Canyon. And we must run right to that.
Oh, really? But the other thing that happens when you turn around, what we've done is a walk past what we call a floating wall in the galleries. And so we have two sight lines. One is right to that David Hockney, which is this garish, bright view of the Grand Canyon. But then when you turn around to where we were, in the opposite wall where the water lilies is a forest landscape by Gustav Klimt. He was, of course, known for his society portraits, and I think his technique in those paintings actually informs the painting we're looking at. But what we're looking at, to be precise, is a birch forest. It's surrounding a lake called the Attersee, which is between Vienna and Salzburg. And what's so compelling about this painting is the way that he paints the forest floor. The leaves have fallen. They're yellow, orange, red. And some of the yellows just glow and glisten. It's painted actually quite meticulously, very deliberate strokes.
Just a quick question, Standard Oil. How did this end up in the final room of a landscape show?
Well, I certainly won't get into certain logistics that are about where things look better in a gallery. But so the Standard Oil, what you're talking about, is this really fascinating painting just done in shades of black, gray, and white. Looks almost like it's a spray painted, and it is a Standard Oil gas station. Ed Ruscha is well known for these. Some of them are in color. Some of them, they're on different scales. The Standard Oil is just such an elemental experience of the American kind of suburban life, right? The gas station. And one he shows here is clearly one from the 50s. I like that it ends the show because, like Canaletto in Venice that opens the show, we have ways in which buildings in landscape and our experience of landscape can have such a nostalgic effect. It is certainly about a quintessentially American landscape.
Vanessa Schmidt, New Orleans Museum of Art Curator of Seeing Nature. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Eileen.
Seeing Nature Landscape Masterworks will be at the New Orleans Museum of Art through January 15th. The exhibit will then close at the Seattle Art Museum early next year. Now, across town, New Orleans jewelry artist and sculptor Thomas Mann is reaching out to artists affected by the August floods with an event called Feast. Mann will don his chef's hat for the occasion that is part art installation and dinner with a theatrical touch. Thomas Mann joins us.
Hey, hi, Diane. Thanks so much for having me on.
We are seeing a different side of you in this event.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
What exactly is Feast, and how will it help flood-affected artists?
The exhibit takes place in the gallery space on the first floor of my building at 1812 Magazine Street. And the dinner will take place on the deck just outside of our studio kitchen on the second floor of the same building. And so Feast happens as an exhibition, and Feast happens as a dinner. The dinner is going to be a very specialized menu where I combine normal cooking capabilities with a new kind of version of cooking, which is called molecular gastronomy. So guests will enjoy a presentation of food in a most unique form. It will be sculptural, it'll be artistic, it'll be exciting, and it will be kind of mysterious all at the same time. So for instance, the first course is what I call a sculptural garden salad. Everything on the plate will be edible, but it won't look like it. You're looking down from a height on a sculpture garden, like at the museum here in New Orleans, right? And all of those little bits that are down there you can pick up and eat, right? And then there's going to be a deconstructed corn chowder.
Ooh.
All right? So I'm working on a cookbook called Deconstructed Food, where I take a recipe apart and then put it back together in different ways, ranging from vegan to omnivore, and how to make it in those different kind of scenarios. But at the top of each page is a brooch, a piece of jewelry that looks like corn that comes apart and then goes back together by the end of the recipe, right? So the deconstructed corn chowder. Then there's going to be a sculptural papillote tent. Papillote is a bag in which food is cooked in an oven where you put a lot of components together and then you bake it and then you open it up and eat it. But in this case, the bag is going to be very sculptural in aluminum foil and it's going to be smoked. So I'm going to smoke the contents of it at the very end of the cooking process. And when you open it up, you're going to get this beautiful wood smoke surrounded presentation of the food.
And what's being smoked?
Depending on the food preferences of the diners, I will do a vegan version. I could do a vegetarian version. I'll do a fish, and I'll probably do a poultry of some sort.
Oh, very nice.
Right. And then for dessert, we're going to have Elvis is in the building.
Tell me more.
Elvis in the building is based on this beautiful handmade Elvis profile waffle iron that I got from an artist in California some years ago that produces this incredible waffle that looks just like Elvis.
Of course.
And then, you know, we surround this with a fruit or a whipped cream or a foam or something that takes it to an interesting kind of place. And there may be other things that will include it by the time I get this all done. I'm experimenting almost every night with the things that are going to go into this dinner.
Now, the exhibit, what will we experience there?
Well, the Feast exhibit takes place in Gallery Iowa. It's basically a tabletop show, a tablescape that I've constructed on a table that I built, where we are presenting the objects made by artists from all over the country in ceramic, in wood, in glass, in metal that are used for food presentation. Also included in that exhibit are jewelry objects from a lot of different artists. Like myself, I made an artichoke necklace and carrot earrings. We have potato chip earrings. We have cupcake pins. We have a lot of very interesting work that's come in from the artists that we represent on an ongoing basis, but some new ones that we solicited just for this opportunity.
And all of the proceeds that are raised during this Feast tablescape,
yeah,
and the Feast dinner and reception is going to go towards SURF.
Yeah. And SURF is the Kraft Emergency Relief Fund, and it is an organization based in Vermont that has given grants to artists suffering floods, fires, health issues for the past 30 years. And they did a big job right after Katrina, and now they're about to do it again for the Louisiana flood artist victims. It's one of my favorite organizations, and I've been associated with them for a long time, and whenever I can, I try to help them out.
Jewelry artist and sculptor Thomas Mann, thanks for stopping by.
Oh, Diane, thanks so much for having me and doing what you do.
The Feast for SURF Dinner takes place on Friday at Thomas Mann's Gallery I.O., 1812 Magazine Street. The Feast Tablescape is on view at Gallery I.O. through November 12th. For more info, you can Google Feast for SURF. That's C-E-R-F. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at wwno.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go inside the arts. I'm Diane Mack.